Welcome to the Superman Fan Podcast. My name is Billy Hogan, and I'll be your host. Before we begin our journey through the time barrier, please ensure that your red indestructible capes are securely fastened around your necks so that we can safely travel back through time and explore more Silver Age adventures of the Man of Steel. This is episode number 380, part 1, featuring the Superman Family comic book, cover dated March 1965. Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen, number 83, for the week of Wednesday, July 25th, 2018, which is when I'm recording this, a little bit before lunchtime. Yesterday, I finished reading the July previews, so I'm all caught up on my comic book reading, and I'll be ready for the next shipment from Discount Comic Book Service, which will come at the end of next week or the first full week of August. Hard to believe we're almost through summer and school's about to start again. So I finished reading the main part yesterday also of the book The Disappearing Spoon, which is a book about the history of chemistry and the periodic table. And I wish I had that book when I took chemistry as a high school senior, because it gives an excellent history of the science of chemistry in a way that a layman like myself could understand. Next on my stack of non-comic book reading is the book The Law of Superheroes, written by attorneys James Daly and Ryan Davidson. It takes a look at comic book superhero tropes, heroes, and powers through the lens of our legal system. So I'm looking forward to reading that book as much as I did The Physics of Superheroes, which was written by an actual physicist, James Kakalios. Once I receive my next shipment from Discount Comic Book Service, I'll post on Twitter the list of titles that I received, so stay tuned. And after I receive the next issue of previews, I will also submit some clips to the Comic Book Page podcast preview spotlight episode, which will be edited together by John Mayo. Look for that about the first or second full week of August. So after a promo for another comic book podcast, we'll begin looking at Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen, number 83.
The dawn of an age. The founding of a family.
You know we haven't done enough research into the effects of cosmic rays.
We've got to take that chance.
Conditions are right tonight. Let's go.
They're penetrating the ship. Our shielding isn't strong enough.
I feel like I'm burning up.
Too heavy. Can't move.
Too heavy.
We're all alive.
I feel so strange.
You're fading away. I can't see you at all anymore.
Look what's happening to you. You're changing.
Oh, Reed, not you too.
What happened to me? To all of us?
I can fly.
We gotta use that power to help mankind, right?
And so was born the Fantastic Four.
For soon the Mole Man will have the entire world in his power.
I am the mightiest living mortal on Earth. And half mankind shall feel that might.
The Fantastic Four. Little do they dream, they're the palms in the hands of Dr. Doom.
The Human Torch will be the Puppet Master's next victim.
You Earthlings can't change the way I can. That means I'm the most powerful person on Earth.
I've been expecting you, for I am the Thinker.
I vow never to return, my lord, until the Fantastic Four are no more and the planet Earth is no more.
You're in the presence of the awesome Ralatot, King of Kings, Master of Men, and Lord of the Seven Suns.
Fool, you're just a muscular freak, blind or Hulk.
Stop! You must not enter the castle of Diablo.
My journey has ended. I shall sustain until it is drained of all elemental life. So speak, Galactus.
Flame on!
It's clobbering time!
The Fantastic Four from the very beginning. Witness the origins of a legend. The Fantasticast. ffcast.libsyn.com.
The first story in Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen number 83 was 9 pages long, titled The Nostradamus of Metropolis, written by Leo Dorfman, penciled by John Fort, inked by George Klein, and lettered by Milt Snappin. Jimmy Olsen was driving through Metropolis Park on his way to work at the Daily Planet when he saw an old man with long white hair and beard wearing a purple robe, holding a rolled parchment and a crystal ball standing in front of a cave. The man introduced himself as Nostradamus, the prophet, and explained that he fell asleep while writing some of his predictions and awoke to find himself in a strange city. Jimmy informed him that he had lived 400 years ago and he was in the 20th century city of Metropolis. Nostradamus assumed that one of his enemies must have cast a sorcerer's spell on him to send him into the future. Jimmy was skeptical that he was the real Nostradamus and asked him to look into his crystal ball and tell him who he was. In order to prove he's not a charlatan or a quack, he looked in his crystal ball and revealed that his name was Olsen. That impressed Jimmy enough to drive Nostradamus into Metropolis and introduced him to Perry White, who was also skeptical. Even if he was real, his prophecies were known to have been vague and could be interpreted to mean anything. Jimmy pointed out that his prophecies had come true in relation to the French Revolution and Napoleon. An editor's note at the bottom of this panel mentioned the books Oracles of Nostradamus and The Complete Prophecies of Nostradamus, which should be available in most libraries. To prove his prophecies worked in the 20th century, he looked into his crystal ball and predicted that at 10 o'clock the next day, every drop of water in the city would freeze. Jimmy convinced Perry to print the story of the prediction and decided to put it on the front page. Perry warned Jimmy that if the wacky prophecy failed, that he would be fired. Clark didn't say anything, but he was worried that Jimmy actually believed this nonsense, as Clark put it. The next morning, after the Metropolis public saw the front page of the latest edition of the Daily Planet, a crowd gathered at the hermit Nostradamus' cave in Metropolis Park, waiting for 10 o'clock to arrive. Suddenly, at 10 a.m. sharp, all the water in Metropolis froze. Whether you were in the bathtub, or trying to get a drink out of a water fountain, or even washing your car with your water hose. Clark was at a nearby lake, and when it froze, trapping a fisherman's boat, seconds later Superman flew over Metropolis using his heat vision at a wide angle to melt the ice, and worked at super speed to get the city out of cold storage. The next day, Jimmy's job was safe, but Perry still wondered how what he described as a kooky prophet had turned Metropolis into an ice house. Jimmy didn't know, but he planned to find out with the next prediction. Clark decided to join him because now he was intrigued by Nostradamus. Soon, in front of his cave, Nostradamus predicted that at high noon the next day, every tree in Metropolis would launch into space. Clark wondered if it could possibly come true. The next day, a large crowd gathered near Nostradamus' cave and waited to see if it came true. Exactly at noon, every tree ripped out of the ground and began to fly up into the air into space. Moments later, the Man of Steel carried a transparent, pressurized sphere with Jimmy inside, and he took pictures of the trees flying in space while Superman wondered how Nostradamus foresaw it. On the next page, we have a full-page ad for the G.I. Joe original 12-inch action figures from Hasbro. And now back to our regularly scheduled comic book story. The Man of Steel and Jimmy paid a visit to Nostradamus outside his cave, and Superman demanded that the mystic reveal his secret oracle power. While the crystal ball revealed much about Superman to Nostradamus, he refused to reveal his secret. Instead, he gave another warning, that at sunset that day, a fiery meteor would plunge to Metropolis. Jimmy was thrilled about another scoop for the Daily Planet, but hoped the Man of Steel would be able to stop the meteor from causing any damage. As news of the grim prophecy flashed across the nation, people held their breath. Jimmy broadcast live on TV while Nostradamus gazed into his crystal ball. Superman was nearby, gazing at the sky, but saw no sign of an approaching meteor. Suddenly, a meteor appeared in the sky, and the Man of Steel flew to catch it and hurl it back into orbit. But unknown to Superman, a piece fell off the meteor, striking the boathouse on the nearby lake, and Jimmy told Nostradamus to ring the fire alarm, which he did. After the fire department extinguished the flames, the chief thanked Nostradamus for helping save the boathouse. Nostradamus shared the credit with Jimmy for spotting the meteor strike. As Jimmy was about to leave, Nostradamus saw a new threat in his crystal ball. An earthquake would hit Metropolis at 3 p.m. the next day, and Jimmy hurried away to warn the Man of Steel. Once Jimmy left, the hermit Nostradamus opened a concealed door in his cave and laughed that Jimmy had fallen for a scheme. Inside the secret door was a radio which he used to contact Lex Luthor. Nostradamus informed the criminal mastermind that the earthquake prediction had been made, so everyone would be leaving the city, so it would give them the perfect opportunity to loot Metropolis at their leisure. The next day, everyone evacuated Metropolis. Jimmy piloted the Daily Planet Flying Newsroom helicopter to cover the traffic jam out of the city, and wondered where Superman was and hoped he was checking on his hunch. Far below Metropolis, the Man of Steel burrowed in search of a volcanic rock activity fault under the city. Jimmy's suspicions seemed unwarranted, but Nostradamus' predictions had not been proven wrong yet. As he joined his pal above the traffic jam leaving Metropolis, Jimmy spotted one lone car heading towards Metropolis. Superman used his super hearing and X-ray vision to eavesdrop and discover that Nostradamus was really Knuckles Kling, one of Lex Luthor's old henchmen, and learned of the plot to loot Metropolis. The Man of Steel returned to Jimmy and explained their plot. Jimmy was surprised that his suspicion proved correct, and Superman admitted that he should have seen through the disguise. But it wasn't too late to spike the scheme, as the Man of Steel put it. As Jimmy landed the Daily Planet Flying Newsroom helicopter, Superman caught Knuckles and the gang red-handed. After the Man of Steel tied up the gang of thieves, Knuckles was surprised that Olsen had seen through the disguise. Jimmy informed him that he gave himself away when the fiery piece of meteor struck the boathouse, and noticed that Nostradamus rang the fire alarm without asking what a fire alarm was, because they had not been invented in the 16th century, and thus deduced that Nostradamus was a phony. Superman used his super voice to project a message to the evacuating citizens of Metropolis, revealing that the earthquake prediction was a hoax and that it was safe to return to their homes. Later, at police headquarters, Jimmy asked the Man of Steel how he knew there would be no earthquake. Superman explained that his microscopic vision discovered that the crystal ball was actually a power crystal from the Zagar galaxy that Luthor had probably stolen. The crystal was powered by the amplified brainwaves of people, which converted thoughts into reality. Zagorian geniuses had used it to turn their plans into machines that they needed. The Man of Steel deduced that Knuckles was aware that human brain power lacked enough energy to power the crystal, and had tricked everyone to think the same thing as they watched the crystal. Their concentrated thoughts of thousands of people supplied the energy to fulfill the prophecies. Superman also revealed that Knuckles never intended to create an earthquake. He only wanted everyone out of Metropolis so they could loot the city. To demonstrate the crystal's power, the Man of Steel used his super brain to bring back all the trees that Knuckles had sent into space. Everyone in Metropolis watched as the trees, apparently undamaged, returned, rooting themselves back to Earth. Soon, Jimmy and his super pal, who was still holding the crystal, visited Knuckles in jail, and Jimmy predicted that he would spend the next 20 years in prison. And the Man of Steel predicted that Knuckles would never lay hands on the crystal ball again because he was returning it to the Zagar galaxy. After another promo for a comic book podcast, I'll review this first story in Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen number 83.
Welcome to the future. Our future. And soon to be your future. Well, until the next retcon, or reboot. Welcome to the Legion of Substitute Podcasters, forged in the past by tales of the future, the Legion of Substitute Podcasters. And now, the secret origin of the Legion of Substitute Podcasters. You know, someone should do a podcast about the Legion of Superheroes.
Yes. Yes, they should.
We should ask the guys at CGS to do it.
But aren't they kind of busy?
Oh, no. It would be a great idea.
I'm not so sure about this. I mean, they have the weekly podcasts they do. They are planning all their con appearances, setting up interviews with comic talent, scheduling the next super show, and restocking the bar for their next anniversary episode.
Oh, come on. It'll be an easy sell.
Let's go in and tell them about it. Wow, they are tough.
What are you talking about? We never got past Tasha and the dogs.
Choke. Now our dreams will never come true.
No, wait. I'm having a flash of precognition.
Really?
No, but we need a plot device to get to the point, don't we?
True that.
I see us, talking across wide distances with other Legion fans. I see us doing it, Paul and Rick. Don't you see? We're the Legion of Super Podcasters!
We can't be the Legion of Super Podcasters. We were just kicked out of the club.
Then we'll be the Legion of Substitute Podcasters. One day we'll prove that we are worthy.
Yes!
We've heard that people have a tough time understanding Legion of Superheroes. It's hard to keep track of which lad, last boy, or girl is which. And what the hell's a Xanthu anyway? Let us make that a lot easier for you. Join Paul French, Rick Croxton, Darren Noel, and our mystery Legionnaire for a fun ride through the history of the future. www.legionofsubstitutepodcasters.com.
At the beginning of the story, it must be a slow news day if Jimmy thought that an old guy standing in a robe by the side of the road would make a good story. As the story proved, Jimmy was right, but on page 2, when Perry was excited to publish the prediction, it made the Daily Planet seem more like a tabloid that you would find at the grocery store checkout line. Some of the predictions that Jimmy cites at the bottom of the page were some of the actual historical events that Nostradamus is claimed to have predicted, but doing a quick search on the internet said that the jury is out on Nostradamus in some circles because of his constant ambiguity and openness to interpretation. So keep that in mind if you read Nostradamus's work. On page 3, I felt sorry for the woman stuck in her tub when all the water in Metropolis froze. I hope she didn't get any frostbite, and I also hate to think how many busted pipes there must have been in Metropolis. Plumbers were going to be very busy for a while in that city. On page 4, when the trees of Metropolis flew into space and the people were gathered by Nostradamus' cave, it looked like they were watching the moon launch. On page 5, Superman seemed to let the meteor fall a little too close to the ground before he caught it. Maybe it's the angle that John Fort chose to draw the scene. From this angle, it would be real hard to show Superman catching it much higher than almost ground level without the Man of Steel almost looking like a stick figure in the sky if he caught it higher up in the atmosphere. While John Fort is a good average comic book artist, he really is not my favorite. On page 6, I did not pick up on the clue at the top of the page when Nostradamus tripped the fire alarm without asking what it was, but in the scene, Jimmy gives a hint by pointing towards it. Still, someone from the Middle Ages probably would not know how it worked or where you flip the switch or anything. I'm surprised there was anything left of the boathouse after the fiery meteor hit it. At the bottom of the page, after the big prediction about the earthquake in Metropolis, This is when we learn it's a hoax by a member of Luthor's gang. On page 7, I'm surprised that the Man of Steel burrowed underground searching for the rock vault under the city. Unless there's a lot of lead pipes under the city, which would block his X-ray vision. Living in Florida for many years, in hurricane season, I think the gang overestimates how many people would evacuate, because when a hurricane approaches, there's always people who refuse to heed evacuation warnings and stay put, hoping to get by on extra food and drink to ride out the storm. Regardless, on page 8, did the gang think that the Man of Steel would not remain behind to try to mitigate any possible damage caused by the earthquake? And I've got to give Jimmy credit to pick up that Nostradamus knew what a fire alarm was, even though he's supposed to be from a number of decades in the past. Metropolis is also lucky to have Superman serve as an emergency broadcast system to alert the citizens that the emergency was over and they could return to the city just by yelling. At the bottom of the page, he also proves himself a gem expert, able to learn that the power crystal came from another galaxy just from using his microscopic vision. On page 9, this is the most interesting part of the story with the Man of Steel's revelations about the crystal ball, which could transform the thoughts of the citizens into reality through the fake Nostradamus predictions. One thing that's not explained is what stopped the earthquake from happening. Was the crystal ball stored away, shielded from people's thoughts as they evacuated Metropolis? This story does touch on the idea of manipulating the public, which we see in politics and advertising and every other aspect of society today. At the bottom of the page, there must have been some magic involved in the crystal, which would explain why the trees were not killed by the vacuum of space. This is one of the most outlandish, complicated criminal schemes I've seen, when the gang tried to manipulate the citizens of Metropolis to evacuate the city so they could walk in and take all the money they wanted. They would also have to assume not only that Superman would leave, but even the police would evacuate. I'm not sure that would be totally the case, maybe because of the danger of earthquake, but I would think it would be possible that there would be some police officers stationed in hopefully safe places away from tall buildings that could collapse on them in order to keep order in the city while the city was evacuated and to try to stop some of the damage caused by fires and gas leaks. You can chalk it up to your typical weird, overly complicated criminal plot from the Silver Age. And I give this story a C- because it was a lot of fun to read. On the top 2/3 of the next page, we have the humor strip Peg, written, drawn, lettered, and signed by Henry Boltonoff. Peg's date planned to take her to the movie. Unfortunately, the theater was closed because the popcorn machine was out of order. On the bottom 1/3 of the page, we have an ad for Silly Putty, which you can still buy today. On the following page, we have a full-page, full-color public service announcement titled Friends Across the Seas, written by Jack Schiff, drawn by Sheldon Moldoff, and lettered by Ira Schnapp. This PSA encouraged students to become pen pals with children across the world to learn the different cultures and customs of other nations. After another promo for a comic book podcast, we'll take a look at the second story in Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen, number 83.
Why do you think superheroes are so important?
People need heroes because they need somebody to inspire them, something to aim for, somebody to try to be like.
One is the Man of Tomorrow, with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. The other, the Caped Crusader, carrying out a solemn vow to spend his life warring on all criminals. For 7 decades, they've been the world's finest heroes. They've teamed on radio, comics, newspapers, animation, and more. And now, they're teaming up for a podcast.
To the Batmobile. Let's go.
Up, up, and away!
Atomic batteries to turbines to speed.
Superman and Batman celebrates more than 70 years of the world's finest team with randomly chosen stories featuring the Man of Steel and the Dark Knight. Superman and Batman, featuring your two favorite heroes in one podcast together. Find it today at greatkrypton.com.
The second story in Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen number 83 was 7 pages long, titled The Great Miss Universe Contest. Written by Sam Rolfe, penciled by Kurt Swan, inked by George Klein, and lettered by Melt Snappin. At the end of another busy day of the Daily Planet, Perry discovered that Jimmy was dressed in a tux and top hat, just like he was. While Jimmy was going to perform magic for his fan club, Perry was going to be one of the judges for the Miss Universe contest at the Apex Theater near Jimmy's clubhouse. So, Perry offered to share a cab ride with Jimmy. Once they arrived at the theater, Jimmy kidded Perry about offering to trade places, and obviously Perry declined. Since they had arrived early, the Daily Planet editor-in-chief went to get a cup of coffee. Across the street from the theater, Jimmy performed magic tricks inside his clubhouse, then took the club members outside to show his force shield belt given to him by Brainiac 5 of the 30th Century's Legion of Superheroes. Then he showed the panel, which had 3 buttons, and he demonstrated what each could do. He asked the club members to make snowballs and throw them at him, and they discovered that the first button was a force shield which prevented the snowballs from hitting Jimmy. The second button let him defy gravity and allow him to float or possibly even fly, and the third, he simply said that it would make people invisible, but he couldn't demonstrate it because there was a flaw in the apparatus. At that moment, Perry rounded the corner and Jimmy accidentally touched the wrong button. Perry became invisible. Unfortunately, the flaw in the device was that he couldn't make his boss visible again. Perry had to wait 24 hours for the effects to wear off. So Perry ordered Jimmy to take his place as a judge. Jimmy entered the theater and met his girlfriend Lucy Lane, who happened to be Miss Metropolis. She gave him a big kiss. He realized that Lucy must think that with him as a judge that the contest is in the bag for her. He thought, maybe it is. He couldn't think of anyone who could possibly be more gorgeous than she was. As the pageant began, the contestants marched on stage in their one-piece bathing suits. Jimmy told the other judges that Miss Metropolis topped them all. The other two judges agreed, but when Jimmy went to write his ballot, Miss Metropolis, the letters disappeared. Then, to Jimmy's astonishment, the pencil floated out of his hand and wrote the name Miss Platonia. Jimmy had never heard of that country before, but he found out that the same thing happened to the other two ballots because Miss Platonia was crowned the new Miss Universe. After the pageant was over, outside the theater, Lucy refused to listen to Jimmy's attempt at his explanation. She went so far as to slap him in the face, never wanting to see him again. After Lucy walked away, the new Miss Universe approached and introduced herself as Diala and thanked Jimmy for voting for her and asked if he could take her picture. Jimmy was glad to, and so he took her to the Daily Planet where he had left his camera. When he developed the picture, there was only a blurred outline, forcing Jimmy to assume that the film must have been defective. But he was still smitten by Diala and treated her to dinner. But he didn't expect her to eat 5 steaks, racking up a $75 bill, which today would be $600, which would be a lot of money for a cub reporter's salary. Since Jimmy did not have enough money to pay for the bill, both he and Diala had to wash dishes in the kitchen. But Diala didn't mind. She loved housework and asked him what other girl would wash dishes so cheerfully. While he dried dishes, Jimmy thought that she might make a swell wife if she didn't need him out of house and home, that is. Later that night, after they were done washing dishes, he wanted to take her to the hotel ballroom. Unfortunately, by the time they got there, it was empty. The orchestra had already gone home, so they couldn't go dancing. But Diala wanted to dance anyway and took Jimmy's hand. Then the musical instruments began playing by themselves. Still later, Diala suggested that Jimmy drive her into the country, where he noticed a flying saucer had landed, but it happened to belong to her, and she offered to take him to her home planet of Plutonia. As they traveled in deep space, Jimmy got an even bigger surprise when Diala transformed into her normal protoplasmic form and offered to transform Jimmy into a Plutonian, which she did despite his protests. She then told him that they could marry as soon as they landed, and Jimmy thought that he looked like he came from the TV show Outer Limits. The only good thing about his situation, he thought, was that he could blend in with the protoplasmic citizens of Plutonia. Once they landed, Diala exited the ship first and was about to introduce Jimmy to her people when an invisible force pushed Jimmy back into the ship. Then the door slammed shut, and the spaceship took off back into space. Then he heard Perry's voice come from the pilot's chair. He explained that when Jimmy met Diala, he smelled trouble and so followed him. Then he activated the protoplasmic converter, returning Jimmy to normal. Perry couldn't wait until they arrived back on Earth so he could tell Lucy Lane what Jimmy looked like as a protoplasmic Plutonian. Jimmy kidded that maybe he shouldn't have been rescued because being a Plutonian was easier than explaining why he didn't vote for her as Miss Universe. After another promo for a comic book podcast, I'll go over my notes for this second story in Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen number 83.
Journey that will take us many years into the past, where a long time ago, character Superman first graced the pages of Action Comics. But there was technology more advanced, and it brought forth a race of moviegoers, men and women like ourselves, but advanced to the absolute peak of human entertainment. They wanted to see their character adapted in other media. They made him
the Man of Screen.
Man of Screen podcast will chronicle the adventures of Superman on the big screen and the small screen, starting with the Fleischer Shorts, the Kirk Allen movie serials, Superman and the Mole Men, the 1950s television series, The Adventures of Superman, the Christopher Reeve movies, Lois and Clark, Superman the Animated Series, and more. Come check out the Man of Screen podcast, coming in March to manofscreen.podomatic.com.
At the bottom of page 2 and top of page 3, it's never a good idea to turn your boss invisible. For one thing, you'll never know where he could be in the office. He might hear his employees talk about him behind his back. I'm surprised that Jimmy was allowed to be a judge when his girlfriend is a contestant. In real life, there'd probably be an alternate judge in case he was needed, but that's not the point of this story. On page 4, I can only conclude that when the pencils floated by themselves and wrote Miss Platonia on the ballots, that it had to be Perry, who never confessed his responsibility at the end of the story. So who knows? When Lucy slapped Jimmy, while I can understand her being upset that he didn't vote for her, it was a bit shallow to say that she never wanted to see him again. So the continuation of their relationship depended on whether or not Jimmy voted for her? At the bottom of the page, it's never explained why Diala picked Jimmy, unless, looking back at the panel where we see the other two judges, it was apparent that Jimmy was younger than him and, more than likely, was closer to her own age. When Jimmy's picture of Diala was blurry, I wondered if she was some type of vampire, because according to legend, vampires can never be seen in mirrors or pictures. On page 5, do all Platonians have telekinesis powers, or is it only Diala? Because it's the only explanation about why the musical instruments could play by themselves. On page 6, it must have been a big letdown to Jimmy when he learned that Diala was really a protoplasmic being. She reminded me of Proti and Proti 2, pets of the chameleon boy of the Legion of Superheroes. Their home planet is only given as in the Antares system, but that planet is not given a specific name, so could they have come from Platonia? On page 7, Platonians seemed friendly. There was nothing menacing about them. I'm sure, though, that Jimmy was glad to return to normal. When it's revealed that Perry pushed Jimmy back into the ship and flew them back to Earth, I couldn't help but wonder, Perry must have been a good study, first of all, to learn how to operate the ship, first of all, without letting Diala and Jimmy know he was in there, and second, to learn so quickly how to operate a piece of alien technology. And I couldn't help but wonder if Biala's ship had a bathroom compatible for human use. As boisterous and vocal as Perry was, I'm surprised he could keep quiet during their voyage. Still, I wonder if it was a maneuver to give Jimmy a taste of his own medicine and get a bit of revenge for turning him invisible on Perry's part. If so, it proves that Perry can be a little vindictive, especially when Jimmy did it by accident. But still, it was a fun twist to a story, and I have to give this one a B+. After another promo for a comic book podcast, we'll take a look at the Jimmy Olsen's Pen Pal Letter Column.
Beautiful as Aphrodite. Wise as Athena. Stronger than Hercules. Swifter than Mercury. Explore the 75-year history of the Amazon Princess with Wonder Woman, Warrior for Peace, a monthly podcast available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wonderwomanwarriorforpeace.wordpress.com.
The Jimmy Olsen Pen Pals Letter Column begins, Dear Editor, I've spotted a mistake in Jimmy Olsen number 81. In The Ransom of Superman, you show the Man of Steel flying away with a lead box full of kryptonite. This box is drawn with two sides showing and with two hinges on each side. No wiggling out, please. You couldn't open the lid of a box like that. Signed, Stephen Scherer of New Hyde Park, Long Island, New York. The editor admitted, I guess we flipped our lid on that one. Dear editor, I finally caught you. Recently you said that Merlin the Magician was an ancestor of Mr. Mixius Pydlik. This is impossible, for Merlin was born in ancient Europe, while Mixius Pydlik was born in the fifth dimension. I will settle for an apology. Signed, Joe Pickey of Tonawanda, New York. The editor replied, Okay, we'll apologize just as soon as you produce Merlin's birth certificate, providing he was born in Europe rather than in the fifth dimension. Dear editor, in the Bizarro Jimmy Olsen, you have Jimmy in the Bizarro Asylum saying, put me in a straitjacket. Because of the Bizarro code, shouldn't it be, put me in a crooked jacket? By the way, I think your comics are neat. Signed, Michael Pop of Palm Springs, California. If it were a straight jacket, you'd be right, but straight means narrow, confining. Therefore, the bizarro opposite of a straight jacket would be a loose jacket. Dear editor, I found a mistake in the Bizarro Jimmy Olsen. You showed Jimmy thinking, those singing Beatles are wearing white wigs instead of black. I'm a Beatle fan, and I'd also like to say the Beatles don't wear wigs. Also, only Paul McCartney has black hair. The rest have brown hair. Signed, Barbara Freeman of Bergenfield, New Jersey. The editor wrote, since the real Beatles don't wear wigs, the Bizarro Beatles do. As to hair color, Jimmy and the Bizarros had only seen the Beatles on black and white TV. Dear editor, I was looking at some of my back issues of Jimmy Olsen and spotted a goof in The Kid with the Golden Touch. In one place, it says, presently in the office of Perry White, editor of the Dairy Planet, signed Neil Al Chalabi of La Mirada, California. The editor wrote, that goof is us cream. We guess we laid an egg, but you can't cow us. And now, do you think we've milked this gag enough? Dear editor, in The Demons from Pandora's Box, you show Jimmy in his hallucination breaking the bottle city of Kandor and then blaming himself for killing its inhabitants. But the Kandorians, being Kryptonians, would immediately become super when the bottle broke, right? Signed, Les Williams Jr. of Westerville, Ohio. The editor replied, wrong. Jimmy didn't just break the bottle in his dream, but blasted it with a deadly ray which would have wiped out the Kandorians at the same instant it broke the bottle. This letter really kind of hits home when you consider what Brian Michael Bendis has done in the Man of Steel miniseries that has just been published. Dear editor, how do you keep coming up with such good Superman stories? Even after 26 years, they are completely refreshing and wholesome. Take The Ransom of Superman, for example. It was a great idea to have the Kryptonian Crusader held captive right in front of his friends' noses. But that was a sneaky way you got him out of the trap, though it was unique. I have just one question. If an overdose of electricity won't kill a human, and an overdose of kryptonite won't kill Superman, why does an overdose of memory potion affect Jimmy and Jimmy's Indian super pal? Signed, Peter Mancuso of Freeport, New York. The editor wrote, for the same reason that an overdose of poison can affect a person, but just because overdoses of electricity and kryptonite are harmless, it doesn't mean you can go around taking overdoses of just anything and get away with it. And the final letter begins, dear editor, I thought your new Indian hero, Mighty Eagle, in Jimmy's Indian Super Pal was great. I appreciate seeing an Indian as a good person in a comic, a refreshing change from the usual bad guy drivel. My only question is, where does Mighty Eagle live? You place this story in the desert, which is my home ground, but no Arizona Indian wears beads or feathers. However, if Mighty Eagle's desert is in Utah or Nevada, it is quite possible his outfit would be correct, as some Plains Indians make their home there. Being part Cherokee and raised in Arizona, I know a great deal about Indians. But where Mighty Eagle lives doesn't matter. He lives and that is enough. You have done much to erase the popular image of the Indian as a heartless killer. May Mighty Eagle live long. Signed, Beth Oxford, otherwise known as Little Cloud, QA Alithaye. The editor wrote, thanks. We'll accept your explanation that Mighty Eagle lives in Utah or Nevada. We only wish everyone who asks such penetrating questions would also provide such satisfying answers. And the letter column was a little short this month because at the bottom of the page is the statement of ownership, which at the time comic book publishers had to print or submit back in the mid-1960s. On the top half of the next page, we have an ad featuring 80-page giant number 8, featuring the secret origins of the Superman-Batman team, then also the secret origins of Green Lantern, Wonder Woman, Flash, Adam Strange, the Manhunter from Mars, Green Arrow, and Challengers of the Unknown. On the bottom half of the page, we have an ad for Tester Hobby Paints, which come both in bottles of liquid paint and in spray cans. After one more promo for a comic book podcast, we'll take a look at the third and final story printed in Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen number 83, and this one was featured on the cover.
In a world where planets die,
I have come to the conclusion Krypton is doomed.
Did I hear him right?
Where good and evil fight a never-ending battle.
But millions of people will die.
Millions! Once again, the press underestimates me.
One man will become a hero.
Every world needs its heroes, Clark. They inspire us to be better than we are. And they protect us from the darkness that's just around the corner.
One man will rise to the challenge.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird!
It's a plane!
One man will wear spandex.
Well, one thing's for sure, nobody's gonna be looking at your face.
Mom?
Well, they don't call them tights for nothing.
Presenting The Thrilling Adventures of Superman, a podcast looking at the Man of Steel's history via his earliest adventures in comics, radio, and film. Featuring reviews, commentary, creator spotlights, and more. Join the adventure at GreatKrypton.com.
The third and final story in Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen number 83 was 9 pages long, titled Jimmy Olsen's Captive Double, written by Jerry Siegel, penciled by Kurt Swan, and inked by George Klein. This was Siegel's 85th Superman family story and his 137th overall story for the Silver Age. One morning in the Daily Planet, Perry opened a small box on his desk when it exploded, and he assumed that it was one of Jimmy's practical jokes, until he read the message engraved on the inside of the box lid, which read, "This is a sample of what is in store for the friends of Superman. I know he will capture me someday, but I'll get all of you first. Signed, the Mad Bomber." Lois pointed out that it was their bad luck that the Man of Steel was on a space mission and had taken Clark with him, without mentioning when they would return. With Superman gone, she felt that they were sunk. Jimmy felt like he had a good idea and made a quick trip to his apartment and returned with a portable monitor, which he used to contact Kandor's lookalike squad for help. They changed into the same Earth-style clothes worn by their human doppelgangers, then flew to the Daily Planet. Zol-Lar was a twin for Jimmy Olsen, and R-Rone was identical to Perry White. They were also duplicates of Clark Kent, Lois and Lucy Lane, and Lana Lang. After they arrived, Jimmy used a growth ray projector to enlarge them to full size. Unfortunately, there was not enough of the element to enlarge the entire city of Kandor. Jimmy had a plan to have the lookalikes take their places while the real human friends of the Man of Steel went into hiding for safety. Jimmy would hide in an office closet to keep an eye on things. The real Lois and Perry went to a hideout in the Daily Planet globe built by Superman. It was bomb-resistant, lead-coated, and ultrasound-proofed so that no enemy could eavesdrop on any conversations and learn that there was someone hiding in there. It was also equipped with a monitor, enabling anyone to contact Atlantis or Kandor. Jimmy asked the Kryptonian or Kandorian twins of Lana and Lucy to roam around in an attempt to track down the Mad Bomber. Perry's duplicate R. Roan rushed to the editor-in-chief's office, changing the wiring of the office radio into a space transmitter, and contacted the Superman Revenge Squad, informing them that the plan was proceeding smoothly. He reported that soon the other members of the lookalike squad would be destroyed by Jimmy Olsen. After his radio report, he rewired the set back to normal to cover his tracks of being a traitor to the Kandorian Espionage Corps. Meanwhile, Jimmy set up his office in the Daily Planet closet with a chair, a flashlight, an intercom, and some eats and some pop, thinking that he was a Mata Hari or James Bond, and since he never had it so good. He kept watching the office through a peephole when he saw his girlfriend Lucy Lane enter the office. He realized that he forgot to phone her to keep her away because of the danger, and hoped his doppelganger could handle her okay. She approached Jimmy's desk, informing who she thought was her on-again-off-again boyfriend that her flight had been canceled and she was available for a date. Zol Lar, Jimmy's twin, told Lucy to shove off, he was busy, and said he'd call when he had nothing better to do, maybe in a month. Jimmy hoped he wouldn't wind up in Dutch with Lucy, but was surprised when Lucy didn't get mad. She liked her tiger, in Lucy's words, a lot more, since he was acting more independent and aggressive. She said she wouldn't bother him and just asked him to call her soon, which surprised Jimmy, and he thought he needed to remember that for the future. Later, Jimmy spotted the duplicate of Perry smoking a cigarette, not a cigar, and in a whisper corrected R. Roan, who quickly swallowed his cigarette and whipped out a cigar at super speed and lit it. Soon, Lana entered the Daily Planet office, and Jimmy realized he'd also forgotten to warn her to keep away. Lana wanted Lois to give Superman a cake she had baked for him, and opened it to show Lois. It was decorated with figures of the teen Lana and Superboy, and it said, affectionately, Lana. Lois's twin zapped the cake with her heat vision, melting the decoration without Lana realizing it. She assumed that the decoration was ruined somehow and was unable to give it to him. Jimmy assumed that Lois's duplicate was jealous for the real Lois, but still wanted to warn Lana to stay undercover until everything was safe. Later, the reporter for a rival newspaper approached Clark's desk, accusing him of being a phony because he only got scoops because he was pals with Superman, and was handed stories on a silver platter, just before a light fixture fell where he was previously standing. Clark apologized for being so rough and explained that he needed to get the man out of the way quick, for which the reporter was grateful. That tickled Jimmy, because a duplicate Clark was using his super breath to loosen the light fixture to cover the way he manhandled the guy without betraying the masquerade. The duplicates of Lucy and Lana returned to the Daily Planet without finding any clue to the Mad Bomber. And after Zol Lar checked on Jimmy Olsen, everyone planned to go to lunch, and R. Roan, as Perry, begged off, claiming that he had work to do as Perry White in the office. After the others left, Perry's duplicate used a sun lamp, which he altered, converting it into a super hypnotism ray, which he used to command Jimmy to kill the lookalike squad. After the doppelgangers of the Daily Planet staff and friends returned to the office, a robot entered, revealing that it was sent by the Mad Bomber. It touched a button on itself, detonating it. But since they were Kandorian twins of the real Daily Planet staff, they were, of course, invulnerable and were not harmed. Before they could begin searching in order to catch the villain who sent the bomb, Jimmy zapped them with the shrinking attachment to the growth ray projector, then placed his Kandorian twin Zol Lar in a glass jar and used a tweezer to put a small pebble of green kryptonite in there. Zol Lar begged for his life, reminding that he had saved Jimmy's life many times. like when mobsters cause a safe to break its rope and fall on Jimmy's head, who they thought was Jimmy, and it was Zolar who took his place. After Zolar collapsed, Jimmy used the gold kryptonite ray gun to remove the powers of the rest of the lookalike squad, except, of course, for R-Ron. R-Ron became fearful for his life because he had forgotten to tell Jimmy to spare him when he ordered Jimmy to destroy the lookalike squad. As Jimmy reached for him, R-Ron admitted that he was in league with the Superman Revenge Squad and promised to reward him if Jimmy did not destroy him. The now evil Jimmy asked him to prove that he wasn't just trying to save his skin. R-Ron confessed to being an escaped Kandorian criminal who changed his features to be identical to Perry White when he learned that the lookalike squad was being formed. After being chosen for the squad, during a visit to the Kandorian Espionage Squad headquarters, he slipped on the Thought Brain helmet and contacted the Superman Revenge Squad and explained that he was a traitor of the lookalike squad and promised to destroy the Man of Steel when they went on a mission to Earth. They replied that if he succeeded, they would reward him well, and later instructed him to avenge them of Superman by ordering R-Ron to destroy the lookalike squad. Then he rewired a TV set into a space monitor to prove that he was telling the truth. On the TV screen was a secret asteroid which was being used as a base of the Revenge Squad with their spaceship, which had landed on the asteroid. Suddenly, the monitor showed the Man of Steel capturing the Revenge Squad ship. Even Zolar was alive and told them that he was playing possum. Lois's twin revealed that Kandor's espionage squad discovered R-Ron's treachery, then alerted the other lookalike squad members, as well as Superman and his Earth friends. The Man of Steel himself wrote the Mad Bomber threat and had prepared a box with harmless explosives, which he had also built, along with the exploding robot. Jimmy's biggest surprise of all was revealed when he said he was actually Zolar, who had switched places with Jimmy before they went to lunch, and figured that R-Ron was about to strike. Since he had superpowers and was invulnerable under Earth's atmosphere and sun, Zolar was immune to R-Ron's hypnotic device and only pretended to be evil. The real Jimmy pretended to be destroyed by the fake green kryptonite, and the gold kryptonite ray gun was fake as well. It was all to trick R-Ron to reveal the location of the Revenge Squad's base so the Man of Steel could capture them. Then both Jimmy and Zolar returned to normal, at least for Kandorians, when Jimmy used the shrink ray to return them to their small size. As the lookalike squad returned R-Ron to Kandor, Jimmy released Perry and Lois from the secret room in the Daily Planet globe. Perry was embarrassed that his twin was a traitor plotting with the Revenge Squad. A few days later, the lookalike squad contacted Perry and Jimmy on their TV monitor, informing them that R-Ron had been cured of his criminal tendencies and was now a member of the lookalike squad in good standing. Jimmy asked Chief if he felt better, and Perry said, "Yeah, and don't call me Chief." After one more promo for a comic book podcast, I'll review this third and final story in Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen number 83.
You are cordially invited to attend a podcast that observes the unfolding events of history. Come with me and observe the birth and growth of a legend. From the pages of a 10-cent pulp comic book to the newspapers, radio program adventures, theatrical films, and more. Witness the dawn of the superhero. Golden Age Superman, available on iTunes and at goldenagesuperman.libsyn.com. Every legend has a beginning.
At the bottom of the first page, technically you can say that Superman made a bomb threat, even though they were all in on the gag, apparently. On page 2, Jimmy seemed to have wisdom beyond his years to think up this ingenious plan. As we learn at the end of the story, it was all planned out ahead of time. The lookalike squad made their fourth appearance so far that we've covered on the podcast. On page 3, I thought it was a clever idea to use the Daily Planet globe as a secret safe room, although I would prefer a location like in the sub-basement of the Daily Planet building, because it would be less of a target. On page 4, I wonder if the fact that Jimmy didn't think ahead to realize that he needed to warn the real Lana and Lucy to stay away from the Daily Planet for a little while might have been a clue that he wasn't really the one to think up the plan all by himself. On the bottom of the page, apparently Zol-Lar is not the chummy type. That's a way to talk to girls. I would have to guess he just might still be single. And on page 5, what does that say about Lucy, who's attracted to men who talk mean or condescending to her? I can understand being more attracted to a man who exudes confidence and is a little more assertive, but that's laying it on with a trowel. And I don't think my wife or daughter would really tolerate with me, much less any other man, talking to them like this. Lois's Kandorian twin seems a little bit protective of her against Lana in their fight over Superman's affections by secretly and sneakily ruining Lana's cake. On page 6, Clark's twin came the closest to the real person. It was ironic that Jimmy assumed that he used his powers because he was Clark's Kandorian twin, when the real Clark Kent would have done the very same thing, just but in any story that you could read either in the Silver Age or even today. At the bottom of the page, it was a very clever, understated clue that Zol-Lan changed places with Jimmy. On page 7, if Superman built the robot, I wonder how much damage it caused when it exploded. And if the Daily Planet published a story about the sting operation against Ar-Rhone, would they reveal that fact if it caused damage at the Daily Planet? It was a grim scene as Jimmy seemed to wipe out the lookalike squad so easily. The only problem in this scene is when who we thought was the evil Jimmy was able to put the still superpowered Zol-Lar in a glass and that other members of the squad did not fight Jimmy. Maybe it's another clue that they were all in on the scheme against whoever the squad traitor was. On page 8, it appeared that Ar-Rhone was still had superpowers. Why not fight against Jimmy to save his life or simply fly away? And I wonder how the Kandorian espionage squad learned of Ar-Rhone's treasury. Could they have intercepted his message when he used the thought projection helmet, or maybe planted a bug allowing them to eavesdrop on any conversation or message sent using it? But it's never made clear. On page 9, it was a very well-organized plan to catch Ar-Rhone and the Revenge Squad co-plotters. It worked perfectly. And I was surprised that Ar-Rhone got off so light, but I'm not sure I would want Kandorian methods used on Earth, since mind adjustment would be a very delicate and controversial thing. Despite these nitpicks, this was clearly the best story of the issue, deserving to be featured on the cover, and I have to give this one a solid A. On the top half of the next page, we have an ad for Planes of All Nations. On the bottom half, we have an ad for Daniel Boone's Trek to Old Kentucky. On the following page, we have a full-page DC House ad where you could subscribe to various DC Superman titles. On the inside back cover, we have a full-page black-and-white ad for the Junior Sales Club of America, where you can sell various themes of greeting cards. And on the back cover, we have a full-page, full-color ad for the American Seed Company, where you can sell various flower or garden seeds for money and prizes. And that wraps up our look at Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen, number 83. Next episode, we will continue our look at the Superman comic books cover dated March 1965, with part 2 featuring Action Comics number 322, and we'll wrap up the month with part 3 highlighting World's Finest Comics number 148. And at the end of that episode, we will have our Elsewhere in DC Comics section looking at the other DC issues which carried the March 1965 cover date. Then we will take a look at the Superman comic books cover dated April 1965. Part 1 featuring Superman number 176. Part 2 highlighting Superman's girlfriend Lois Lane number 56. Part 3 featuring Action Comics number 323. And Part 4 highlighting Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen number 84.
This is the official podcast for the Library of American Comics and Eurocomics. My name is Curtis Findlay, and I've got some special news for you. As part of a 10th anniversary celebration, we are launching our very own podcast. And this is an exciting time because this is your chance to get the inside scoop on everything that's happening in the Library of American Comics and Eurocomics. Every month, Dean Mullaney and I will be talking about the month's new releases, as well as some upcoming projects. We'll be talking to some of the people who are working behind the scenes in making these books possible, and in some cases, we'll talk to the creators of the comics that we publish here. But what's most exciting about this podcast, I think, for you guys, is that we'll have a mailbag feature where you will get to ask Dean Mullaney your questions. And you'll be able to get straight from the man in charge the answers to your questions about the books we publish, about what it takes to get these books out there into your hands. You can ask questions about the restoration, questions about working with the creators, gathering materials, cool stories, anything that you want to ask. Send me an email at Curtis with a K, K-U-R-T-I-S, at loacomics.com. And we will hopefully be able to answer most of your questions in the mailbag segment. And we've got some other cool surprises in store with the podcast, so keep your ears open and join us in November when we officially launch our first episode. Hope to see you all there.
Thanks again for joining me for another trip through the time barrier to explore more Silver Age adventures of Superman. You can find the podcast at the supermanfanpodcast.blogspot.com. Please leave a comment at the bottom of each episode, or you can send an email to supermanfanpodcast@gmail.com. Unless you request otherwise, I look forward to reading them on a future episode. The Superman Fan Podcast is a proud member of the League of Comic Book Podcasters and the Comics Podcast Network. The theme music for the podcast is titled Plans in Motion, composed by Kevin MacLeod, part of the royalty-free music library at Incompetech.com. You can join the Superman Fan Podcast group and page on Facebook, and follow the podcast on Twitter at Superman Podcast. You can also follow the podcast on Flipboard, Medium, Stitcher, and Tumblr. Episodes are also available on iTunes and most other podcast aggregators. Superman and all related characters, including the art shown on the podcast, are trademark and copyright of DC Comics, the publishing unit of DC Entertainment, a Warner Brothers entertainment company owned by Time Warner. Any art shown is for entertainment purposes only, and I make no claim of ownership on them. If you're interested in my artwork, go to wayfarercomics.wordpress.com, where each week I will upload a new piece of art. Click on the Art Commissions tab for more information if you're interested in having me create a piece of artwork for you. If you're interested, send me an email to wayfarercomics@gmail.com. And I hope you join me again next week for more Silver Age Adventures of the Man of Steel. And remember, don't forget to wear your red indestructible cape. Last, but most importantly, thanks to Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, creators of Superman. And hey, let's take care of each other out there.